Hello, friends, and happy Friday. We're back for another Friday conversation. I have some very special guests this week that I'm excited to talk about. We're going to be digging into publishing and all the things that go into publishing and writing. And so I'm excited to pick their brains. Bob, will you start us off with an introduction, please? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, sure. Well, thanks for having me, Steve. I'm Bob Gonzalez. I grew up in Pennsylvania. I moved to Florida in my 20s. I used to play college baseball up there, and one spring I decided that I liked it 70 degrees instead of 40 in March and April. So I made Florida my permanent home, and I've been here now almost 30 years. I had a small business. I had a franchise called the Pretzel Twister. Oh. And I wrote it. It was in Destin, Florida, which is the world's luckiest fishing village. And I got into fishing heavily, and I actually named the boat that I fished on the Twister after the store. And after 15 years of being out there fishing, I wrote a book about it. And after I wrote the book, I met Rhonda, our next guest, who you'll meet here in a minute. And it's been fun ever since.
Wow. It's been a ride.
Yeah.
So I'm Rhonda, and he kind of introduced me a little bit. I'm based out of Indianapolis, so I'm kind of a small town girl just north of Indianapolis in the suburbs called Noblesville. And my book is a little bit different, which will provide a lot for your audience. Mine's fiction. It's a suspense novel. And my process was more of, I wanted to show that I could do it. And so that was my first goal in writing, was I want to write a best-selling novel. And that was the only goal. I wanted to get it published. And I met Bob because we are both published by Mindster Media, which then introduced us. And then we're also part of the Merrill Hemingway book club. So we go. Mm-hmm. Get into that later.
Yeah, Mariel wrote the foreword for both of our books, and I thought she did a great job with Rhonda's. I felt like it really touched her.
I think that with hers, you took her back to her roots, though. Yeah. And I think that was, you know, with her grandfather being a fisherman, I think you brought her back to her roots, and because she spent so much time in Florida. So it's two very different feels.
Yeah.
Bob, you had mentioned you had your own business. I would imagine writing is almost like having your own business too, isn't it? Isn't it
kind of the same? Definitely. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. Every author wants to see their book sell, you know, so you approach it as a business. You know, once it's out there, you have a commodity out there on the market, and you try to do what you can with it and sell it as best as you can.
I think that that's something that's real important for those that have a dream of writing, to realize it's not just the creative part. I'm also an entrepreneur. I own a consulting firm, and I do academic counseling and mentoring. And the one thing that I find in that creative process, most people don't realize that writing is not just about the writing process. If you don't approach it from an entrepreneurial thought process, it's going to sit on shelves because you have to understand what the bookseller needs. And sometimes that's a little difficult because different people want different things.
Yeah. Different times too, right? Different times. So Rhonda, you mentioned you wanted to have a bestseller. So for someone out there who's thinking the same thing right now, or just someone who wants to get their books on shelves or in someone's hands, where do you start? What's the first step?
The first step is one page a day. If you don't write, you're never going to actualize that goal. So one page a day, and it's done in a year. You could do more than that, but if you just sit down and do one page, you'd be disciplined about it, then you'll get the book written. Then I would say the second step is where you fine tune it. Mm-hmm. And that is getting feedback from readers, you know, whether it be a beta reader or someone you trust, or, you know, you partnering with it, you know, somebody that's a writer also. If you don't get feedback from others, you don't see where you're missing your audience. And so that's the biggest part, is getting that feedback. And then you approach the publishers. So many times we get so in love with our own work when we're done that, you know, we might as well go down the marriage aisle and say, I do. And then it may never sell because it didn't reach your intended point, because you're so in love with what you've done. You end up making excuses for all the flaws. Well, but I meant to do this and I meant to do that. Have someone that's willing to, you know, be honest about your writing. Like I must have been really hungry one time when I was writing the scene about the police officers when he got his call to go because there was a report of a dead body, right? Mm-hmm. And I had him at the Golden Corral eating. Well, yeah, where do you think and stereotype that a police donut shop or, a, you know, someplace eating, right? So I have him there, and I described every plate that he saw in the line. And the person that read it for me said, I don't think anybody loves food that much. And I'm like, what do you mean? It's, you know, it's beautiful. It's perfect. It's but I knew I had to go back and look at it. And I think there was 5-6 pages talking about it. It had nothing to do with what was going on. But in my thought process at the time, it meant something. Mm-hmm. So you have to have someone that's willing to say, ah, wait a minute, you forgot this. Wait a minute, you need this. So make sure you have a good feedback program.
You know, something that I think a lot of people struggle with, and even I struggle with this sometimes, but it's, so you have your idea and you have something that you like, a book that you want to create or something that you want to create, and you have an audience that you have to target. So how do you kind of make those two points connect where you, how much do you veer off what you want to do to reach a certain audience?
Well, in my case, I didn't know at first I knew I wanted to write a book about my stories, and I didn't know who I wanted to publish it. And when I came across Meinster and that they worked with Mariel Hemingway, I thought, oh, wow, that's it right there. I said, you know, The Old Man and the Sea and Mariel Hemingway, for me, it was an instant connection. And I knew that Meinster would be a good company if they worked with Mariel, you know. And they work with other celebrities, too. They have the Rick from Pawn Stars is one of their celebrity endorsers. And Kevin Harrington, but for me, because of The Old Man and the Sea and because of the assimilate, my dad was from Cuba, where Old Man and the Sea was written. And I had always thought it had been written while Ernest was in Key West, but it wasn't. It was written in Cuba. And she's actually named from one of the ports near Havana called Mariel. That's where she got her name, where her father and her grandfather used to fish there. And my dad was on the other side of the island in a place called Santiago, that's near Guantanamo Bay. And Santiago is the name of the main character in Old Man and the Sea. He's the old man, is Santiago. So I thought, man, you know, I got to give this a try. And it was great. At first, I wasn't even sure if she would even want to do it, you know. And when I put it to them, they gave it to her. And I think she really liked it. Like Rhonda said, it brought her back to her grandfather's and time in Cuba.
For me, I had a slightly different journey because I had never, when I wrote it, I had never heard of Meinster, and I hadn't even begun the publishing process. For me, I thought when I started to write it that it was all going to be about the injustices you see in the legal system, because it's a crime novel, right? And I had been working a lot in this project that would oversee some of the court processes and see if they were equally and treating the different people as they were in the criminal system. But what I found is there is no winners. There is no winners. You might think there's a winning side and a losing side, but really the whole process is about putting everybody in a room. You have all the different, you know, players for whatever reason, and you find out that, you know, they're human. No matter what side of the courtroom they're on. And during that process, and as I was writing, you ask about the intended audience. I realized that it was even a little bit more than just the legal system. I realized it was about those people. And I realized that people need to see people that are relatable, that they can see. So you see the main character who's a workaholic trying to navigate doing jury duty, been trying to get out of it, and they wouldn't let her. And then you see the mother that was just glad to get away from her kids, you know, and be in the jury. You know, you have these different people navigating, you know, this process. But meanwhile, they're all very flawed. You know, they all have challenges, and I wanted people to relate to them and maybe even see themselves in it. So where Bob's is at adventure, and I've read Bob's, and it's fantastic. If you like any kind of adventure, you will feel like you've got that angler and that fishing. Mine's more of learning about people and that people's decisions make their life either better, worse, or, you know, in some cases, if you don't navigate a change, then, you know, it can be detrimental to your life, whether it be getting in a car with a person and you really don't know what their intentions are, or whether it be, you know, just not paying attention because you're working too hard and people can exploit you.
Rhonda's book title is called Crossroads, and I read hers too, and I always tell her, make sure you look both ways before you cross the road.
And that's true.
You know, I have a lot of friends who are writing their manuscripts, and they're trying to get, they're kind of preparing their books for release. I guess what should be some of the things that someone who wants to publish a book, what are some things that they should check off the list before they start to query, before they start to reach out to publishers?
Well, for me, I had to be honest about where I was in my life, because you can go traditional, you can go self, or you can go a blended. Those are the three main ways of publishing. Blended is where you're getting a publisher that's traditional, but they help you with the marketing and they help you understand, you know, hey, this is what the barcode is. This is, and for me, I had to realize I didn't want to wait 2 years. I'm old. I can show my senior citizen card maybe in some places, right? And so do I want to wait 2 years for the traditional publishing house to maybe put it on the shelf? So where in my younger years when I was thinking about it, I had, you know, this idea that that's the route I would go. But then I also had to realize, wait a minute, do you want to learn every part of the publishing process? Do you want to have to learn how to upload it? Do you want to know that it needs to be not only on Amazon, but for you to get in bookstores, it needs to be in Ingram Sparks? Did I want to have to recreate the wheel and start from the beginning? Because I do work, because I have I'm an entrepreneur, I couldn't do that. You know, it would have taken too much time and energy. So I went with the blended matrix. What about you, Bob?
I'll put it this way. I'm not a lion in winter, but I'm not a spring chicken either. So yeah, I'm kind of probably around the same age as Rhonda. I'm 60. I'll be 61 next November. And I never took writing serious. I mean, I had professors in school told me I wrote really well, but I never thought I'd be writing a book. And then about age 55, 56, I thought, you know what? I've got these stories. It's something I enjoy doing. I think people will like it and maybe even learn a few things. And I actually learned a few things myself when I was writing the book. The book took me places I didn't expect to go. One piece I would say, keep an open mind as a writer. The book can take you places. You're not only the book is driving you, and you're driving it. It's a combination. And I would say, take your time with it too. I agree with Rhonda. You know, at my age, I didn't want to spend 2 years learn or 3 years learning the process. going through multiple queries or what. I mean, I didn't have 10 years to spend. You know, I wanted to do it. I wanted to do it well within a relatively short period of time. So I think we both kind of approached it that way.
And for someone who is on that step and looking for potential publishers, blended or traditional, what are some things to look out for? What are some warning signs for authors who are looking into publishers or looking into a blended publisher? What are some red flags that people should be wary of?
I would first say, if you're going to try the traditional query approach, go get the writer's guide from the bookstore that has all the different agents, all the different publishers, and their contact information and what they require to submit. That would be the first thing, because then you can look. The second thing I would say is be careful that you're getting someone that's going to commit to your book and that they're going to fulfill your contract. Make sure the contract is solid and literally check it off. If they said they were going to do X, then make sure that they do X. And if that means you have to follow back with them, then that means you have to follow back with them. You know, it is a business. So make sure everything's in writing. And understand that there's some things that are ego-driven that you don't necessarily have to have. And there's some things that are a must. Like, you must have it on Amazon if you want it to sell. You must have it on Ingram Sparks' website. You know, there's certain websites and certain things that if you want people to be able to buy it, it has to be, you know, it has to be done. That's the main thing. And then when you're ready to start promoting it yourself or with your publisher, that you have a game plan. You need a game plan, or else you'll be spending money left and right and trying to do different kinds of things, and it won't be what traditionally sells books.
What about you, Bob?
Well, for me, I did all the things that Rhonda did. I'm on Amazon and Goodreads and all that stuff. I've had more success, though, with my ground game. I've sold a lot of books myself. I used to do it through my business that I had, but now I'm doing it at Barnes & Noble. They let me have a table every so often. I'm here at my local Barnes & Noble, and I've had great success doing it that way. I have the second best-selling book in my local Barnes & Noble in Naples, Florida, and I didn't expect that to happen, and I don't think they did either. But for going on 7 or 8 weeks, it's been number two. And the books that I'm competing with, most of those are on the New York Times bestseller list. So I'm really happy about that. And that's worked a lot better for me than the online stuff.
And I do agree with Bob. If you can get in front of people and humble yourself when you're doing it, you know, I've had book signings that, you know, you have to be willing to be approachable by people, even if it's not people you know, because you have this idea in your head that you're going to have this book signing, and everybody that knows you and everybody that hears about you is going to show up. Mm-hmm. But in reality, yeah, you'll have some friends and family that show up, and they'll buy them the first couple, but that's not a sustainable model of business. You know, your friends and family, let's say you have 200, you know, that's a good start, but that's not going to sustain the sales. So getting in front of people, however, whether it be your libraries, whether it be your schools, depending on your genre, your bookstores like Barnes & Noble has supported me also. I haven't been quite as lucky as Bob as far as having someone that allows as frequent of signings as I've, but I have more in my area because I'm closer to a big city. So I am getting in front of people is a big part of the selling process. You got to sell yourself.
Yeah, and I've noticed in Barnes & Noble, when in other bookstores too, people are in a good mood when they go in there, so they're open for conversation. Yeah, they're very approachable. Most of the books that I've sold in there, nobody's going in there looking for me, because most of the time they probably don't know me. They just meet me there that day. So even if I approach them first, a lot of times we start talking and, oh, my son's birthday's coming up, or so-and-so would love this, you know, and I've been able to sell a lot of them that way.
Hmm. Which means you need to get to know those managers.
Yeah.
Whether it be an independent bookstore or whether it's a Barnes & Noble, because they have very, you know, different bookstores have different policies on what they'll let you do and what they won't let you do. And I can guarantee you, you're going to get 100 no's before you get a yes. And be prepared for that, though. You know, because once you get that yes, then get in there and you just, you know, just have a good time with it.
I'll tell you a little story. This just happened to me yesterday. A lady walked in with a couple of puzzles, you know, big jigsaw puzzles in the box. And I asked her about the puzzles, you know, because I used to be in a puzzle business for a short time. And she was asking me what the design was and how to do it, because it's Ravensburger, which is a German company, and which make really good puzzles, by the way. Those are really good puzzles. But anyway, she said, oh, they're for the people at my church. The people at the church will love them. And I said, well, do the people at the church like books? So she said, oh, yeah. And then I said, well, look no further than right here. And we started talking, and she wound up getting two of them. So that's how it goes. Yeah. Yeah, that's how it goes. You know, expect the unexpected.
It's kind of like you're going to a convention, but the product is you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and you really have to, here again, it's a business, you know. I would love to say that the creative process is what it's all about, because I love the creative process of it. I like sitting down in my own solitude, my own thoughts, and doing the writing and planning out the characters. And I feel like my way of doing the characters is a lot different than a lot of writers. And it's really, though, once you have that product, it's a product. It's no different than, you know, hairspray, fingernail polish, pretzels, you know. It's a product. Yeah. And if you want to get it out there, that means you have to convince people that they want to read your book. And it might be through an ad. It might be through, you know, seeing you in a bookstore. It might be through a book club, you know, or social media. It might be a variety of different things, and try different things, because one lead will dry up. The other one will open. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, the importance of having an author network that understands those struggles, and you can cry on each other's shoulder when you get your book sales, you know, for the week or whatever, and say, oh, I did terrible this week, or I did great this week, whatever it might be. You can share in that journey. But you have to try different things at all times. It's never, you could do an online, you know, book, what do they call them? Book. Oh my goodness. The name just fell out of my head.
Book tour.
You can do a book tour. There's 100 different ways you can promote yourself, but to do it requires you to follow through and that's where somebody, the blended matrix helps. If I decide I want to do a book tour, I can say, hey, you know, I would like to do a book tour this month. You know, can you sign me up? And, they'll find a good one, and they'll help you get it on the train.
Hmm. Yeah. As far as the writing goes, you know, we're talking about Mariel before. Ernest was a big influence for me. Like we said, I picked up a couple of pointers from him. You know, he's known for brevity. You know, make your points with the most concise words possible. They call that the iceberg theory, where most of the action is underneath the surface. A couple things I learned from him was be positive in your writing. When you're positive, people will gravitate towards that. And also, as a writer, you're understanding as a writer. You're putting yourself in the reader's shoes. You know, you're approaching it as to be am I saying this correctly? To understand, not to be understood. You know, when you're writing, you're understanding, which will convey that understanding to the reader. Hmm. Yeah, those were two pointers that I picked up that stuck with me. And I always like to inject a little humor in my writing.
Yeah, he likes his little one-liners. You'll find that if you follow Bob at A Flicker in the Water, you will see one-liners that will make you chuckle on top of just enjoying the journey with him. Mm-hmm. I would say too, practicing the positivity is important.
Yeah,
staying disciplined, because it is so easy to say, you know what, I don't want to write today, or you know what, I don't feel like doing my social media today, or whatever it might be that's, you know, kind of dragging you through the process. And if you stay disciplined and positive through it and stay focused, it doesn't, you know, you'll get through that moment. But it's very easy to allow it to be overwhelming. And the other thing that we end up always reminding each other on those down moments. One of the biggest authors in the world, Grisham, his first run of A Time to Kill, you would think, oh, that'd be a big one, right? He sold millions, 2,000 copies.
Hmm.
So your goal should look like reality.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not always easy, is it?
But if you look at it and say, okay, if I can sell 1,000 books my first year, or you know, and then get to the 2,000 mark, you know, or whatever that might be, then you're in reality, and anything above that is going to be gravy. And it's hard to get those first 1,000. You know, and anybody that's out there that's already an author knows, you know, it's tough, but you can still enjoy those milestones. Like in Bob's case, that he's on a roll and he's with Barnes and Noble. I'm on a roll on Amazon. You know, so when you hit those best-selling statuses, you're like, oh, wow, I did it. And you can give yourself a pat on the back, and then you got to remind yourself. And I had a loved one that said that. It said, so is that it? Are you done? Or are you going to sell some more books? He said, are you here just for the reviews and people to pat you on the back? Or are you going to sell some more books? Mm. And then I was like, well, I wanted to enjoy that review for a second, you know, but they're like, no, get back right on there. You know, if you don't, you're not going to sell any more books. So you can enjoy those benchmarks. But you still have to every day live, eat, sleep, and consider the book that you have out and the books that you have to come. Like Bob's got a baseball and it has football at the end of it too, doesn't it?
It's a combination. It's I talk about each of the baseball franchises like their history, but in a condensed way from like 1900 to the present, and then. I have some poems about football team, you know, NFL teams, you know, towards the second half of the book. I'm looking about a year from now, maybe to put that one out there. We'll see how it goes.
And then I have so Crossroads, like I said, is about life balance, even though it's a suspense novel. So I have a self-help workbook to help those that are kind of identify with, you know, wait a minute, I want to get more joy in my life and I want to. And it helps you plan that. And then Crossroads has a second one coming out. I would say it's about a year out. Wow. The workbook will be out probably in the next, I'm going to say, 2 months.
I have a lot of friends who are planning on publishing something, and they wonder. A question that I hear come up often is, if I query to find a publisher that won't help me with marketing, why don't I just self-publish? What are the pros and cons of choosing like a blended publisher who will help out with, or have like a team, or have that kind of camaraderie, versus self-publishing where you can potentially create your own team? What are the...
And it's professional. It's a professional model. Mm. My fear for me doing it was, could I produce a high quality product? You know, that it's not just about the cover, although the cover is a big part of it. But even they used to call it in the old days, typesetting and formatting and making sure, like I had a woman that reached out to me and she was self-publishing and she's like, I can't get my spine to be accepted. And I'm like, what do you mean you can't get your spine accepted? She said Amazon keeps on rejecting it. And then I had another, then after they got it, you know, accepted by Amazon, I was like, have you got it on Ingram Sparks? Because at least I've learned the process. And see, Ingram Sparks is the only way you get into bookstores. Nobody's going to touch your book if it's just on Amazon. Mm. And, you know, I would never have known that. So I think it gives you a learning curve and somebody else really kind of keeping it on the playing field with the professionals. You know, and I think that's the biggest part. Could you do it on yourself, all by yourself? I believe you could if you want to learn everything about the publishing industry. You know, if you want to learn about the spine, if you want to learn about the designing of the cover, do you want to learn about the ISBN number? Do you want to know how to learn to put a barcode on it? If you want to learn these things, then you're and you're okay and you have the time to do it, then that's the main difference between a blended publisher. Or do you want somebody to take that part over and have a piece of the pie with you? Hmm. You know, you will never get an endorsement like a Merrill Hemingway or someone in someone's site. And honestly, they have other services there. Like they can even get your manuscript into the movie sets to be considered, you know? So they have these other products that they can help you with if you want to move that direction. Mm-hmm. Now between that and the traditional publisher and waiting it out and trying to do the query and spend the time to do that, you know, if you have time to do it, that's great. If you have ends to do it, that's great. The benefit there is they can help you distribute it. Mm. They have the door opens to all the stores to get them in the stores. But they will only typically budget for you. You know, if you don't sell 20,000 books in that, you know, of that first book, you'll never get published again. Oh, wow. So you can at least make your mistakes or your learning curves or your, you know, building your brand, because it is a brand, through the self-publishing or through the blended matrix.
20,000. That's a lot of books. A lot of pressure, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's no guarantee either in the traditional publishing that the book will sell. You're responsible for your own marketing a lot of times, traditionally published, and you don't ever receive 100% of the royalties. Now, I know with Mindster and some of the things that they offer, you can receive 100% of your royalties, which I really like. You know, I'll do, you know, the work that's required, but then at the end, I'd like to keep 100% of the royalties. You know, that's how I feel about it. And they were good with that, and it's worked out.
It seems like writing the book is the first step, and it's a huge first step. There's a lot that goes into just writing the book and getting it ready for to be published, but it feels like there's so much work after that, like you both have mentioned, to promote it and to constantly be out there selling it and promoting yourself and your work. It sounds like a lot.
It is a lot. It's a whole lot. But I'm looking at it as once it reaches a certain point, they'll know you and they'll recognize the name, and the word will begin to spread that way. So you don't have to promote it yourself as much. They'll do the work for you. Mm-hmm. Word of mouth is free. That's the best thing.
And as you build this group of individuals, readers, audience, supporters. They could be friends or someone you've never met. You know, it could be someone you met in a bookstore or someone that just saw you online. And as you build those engagements, you want to build and work not only on your skills, but you want to learn from them. Like I had a review that I had to look twice at, and I really didn't like it much. Of course, it wasn't one of my better reviews. But then I had to think about what they said about Crossroads for the first one. And I'm like, you know what? I can do that better next time. And the one thing that they didn't give me a terrible review. They gave the one thing that they said was there was a lot of things going on and it wasn't their bag of tea. And it was. So because Crossroads is a suspense thriller that had several characters being introduced, you know, and I'm like, well, you know what? I can tailor that down in Chosen, which is the second one. I can look to see if there's anybody that's not. And I mean, they still gave me a 3.5 review. So it's not, wasn't a bad review. It was just like, okay. And I looked, I had to go look. I was like, well, has this person ever reviewed it? And they'd reviewed like thousands of books. So they were clearly a reader. So I, you know, you want to learn from people too. You don't have to change everything about who you are, you know, and what you've written, but you can learn from everything along the process to learn, okay, wait a minute, that's something I can do myself. Do I change this? Is it part of who I am? And then you move on and you elevate not only yourself, but the peer groups and the people that around you too.
What about you, Bob? Do you read your reviews? That would be nerve wracking for me. I would be hitting refresh every 20 seconds waiting for another review to come in.
I think probably every writer reads their reviews. Even the most famous writers, I think, read their reviews. And they get offended just like new writers. you know, you want to see how people are receiving your work. And you'll know if your work is being portrayed accurately by the reviews or not. And one thing, you're never going to please everybody, you know. So, and I don't think that's the goal. The goal is to just do the best work that you can. And like Rhonda said, try to learn what you can from your reviews. But once you read them and digest them, then, yeah, you know, you take what you can from them and then you just go on to the next one.
And I think like I learn from my good ones too, but I just use that as an example. But I think the one that sent chills down my spine, and I knew that I had created something that people would really enjoy, was when I listened to the review that Merrill Hemingway did, and she released a YouTube video, and it's called Merrill Hemingway Praises Rhonda Parker Taylor's Crossroads. And she goes through and she talks about what the book's about, which is, you know, a workaholic that's, you know, simply just isn't paying attention to her life. And then she talks about how it introduces you to the world of crime, you know. And then at the very end, she starts personalizing it and talked about how there's a time in everybody's life when you have to decide and you know, which way you're going to go. And she said, even chocolate has an expiration date.
Sadly, yeah.
So, you know, and you have to, and that's like, yes, she got it.
I don't know.
Crossroads, which allows, you know, it told a lot about that. She realized that it was more than just the legal system and the suspense. It was a crossroads in each one of those people's lives, whether they were going to jail, whether they were the juror that was having problems going on in her life that, you know, that they had to figure out why this, you know, it's kind of like a game of Clue. Why are all these tragedies happening in the foreman's life, or the mother that has to go back to the children? You know, it didn't matter. You know, they were at a crossroads and they had to decide, you know, how they were going to change things for the better for their lives.
I also have a few friends that self-publish who I think struggle with social media and try to find that line between having their privacy and not being so so present all the time on social media or posting everything that they're doing, but they want to promote their work. Where is that balance for both of you where you kind of, you want to devote time to it, but where are your boundaries for how much you share or don't share, or how much time do you spend? What are kind of your own personal, you know, guidelines?
You want to start, Bobby? You want me to?
Yeah, for me, I just put out what I think is interesting. I don't know if you like baseball, Steve. Are you a baseball fan?
Yeah, I like pretty much any sport.
The other day, I was lucky enough to meet Albert Pujols in the Barnes & Noble here. And this delegation, these people came in with suits and ties, you know, and it looked like a bunch of official-looking people. I'm thinking, what is going on here? So then there's a guy standing in front of me, and a girl who was part of their group approached my table, and I said, is that Albert Pujols? she said, yeah. And I said, you know, if you wouldn't mind, can I have a picture taken with him? So he said, yeah. And a little while later, he came over, and I had a picture taken with him, and I posted that. And things like that, you know, the things that I might not expect to happen, which – I usually don't get into personal stuff. Not usually. I never do, because I don't think that's the place for it. I don't like these people who say, well, I went to the doctor today and he told me I had a kidney stone, you know, and that kind of thing. And I see that kind of stuff all the time and it drives me nuts. I said, I don't want to do that. I put book related things that I think will be interesting. Like that statistic I told you about being the second bestseller in the Barnes & Noble. I post stuff like that, you know, and that's where I draw the line, you know, stuff that I don't want to be repetitive either. I'll document things along the way without being too repetitive. And that's pretty much how I keep it.
Anybody that is out there and follows Bob or sees one of his posts, they need to see the largest red snapper he ever caught. There are pictures out there of it, and he's got it stuffed, and I swear it's as big as me. and so he has very good boundaries. Me, I've tried to do it kind of where I have my personal page where I can share a little bit more, you know, more details of my life on my personal page. And then I have my professional book page. Sometimes I end up sharing the same things to both sides. I find that people like to know that you're human, mm-hmm. you know, and you have some things going on, maybe post my dogs or, you know, those kind of things. But I'm kind of the same way. I don't put a lot of my personal, you know, life, unless it has, you know, if it's something really deep, full and meaning, like I might post, you know, on anniversaries or birthdays or things like that, that are good or bad anniversaries or birthday kind of things. I might comment on that. The other thing is trying to, balance that. It's not just about my book. I try to provide different tips, whether it be research stuff, because I like to research. I do research for a living, or whether it's, you know, maybe a podcast. You know, I would share podcasts because I think people can always learn from podcasts.
Yeah, I do that too.
Whether it be something, you know, something that could be different, that could maybe, you know, engage somebody in a different way, in a meaningful way, or like the eclipse. You know, I'm in Indiana. We got to see the eclipse. Pretty cool. So I posted that.
Nice. You know, just like any other business, it evolves and it changes and we go through ebbs and flows. What are some changes that both of you see coming to the publishing business that you're kind of adapting or preparing for that may change in the next several years or even sooner?
Well, that's a tough one.
Yeah, I think the one thing that is going to change it the most, and it will be in a non-authentic writer's way, is AI. I have mixed emotions about it because, you know, I know some people that are cranking out books very, very quickly. And I would have to say that that's going to change things, not only for the writer, but for the reader. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't realize that anything we do technology-wise changes the way our brains function. And I see it, you know, I'm in academics, so I see it in students' papers where they have, you know, and a lot of teachers and a lot of colleges are allowing you to use AI.
Really?
Yes, because it's not plagiarism, but they're requiring that you have to improve it and make sure it's accurate, because the way AI works is it's a generalization of everything that was on the web a year ago. Hmm. It's not current, first of all. And then it abstracts that information and regurgitates it, and so you don't know if it's right or if it's even wrong. So if a student's using it, they might be, you know, using a wrong theory for a wrong, you know, question or something like that. So I would say that that's going to change the way we think and the way people write, and we will lose that as a skill. It's now, whether it'll be bad or good, time will tell for us, because, you know, people used to only use, you know, oral mm-hmm. mechanisms of telling stories because people didn't read. Now, you know, then it's reading and writing because the press. So what is that going to do? I think there's going to have to be some limitations made on what you can do publishing wise with it. Or you are cutting out the human in it. I don't know if you've ever watched, what was it called? I'll Be Right Back. It's a series, Black Mirror, on Netflix. And it's where a girl is mourning her husband that left. And that's what the last thing he said is, I'll be right back. And her friend convinces her to order this computer-oriented, spouse, basically. Oh. And it ends up that she ends up keeping it, but she knows it's a computer, and it ends up in the attic where her and her daughter can go up and visit and talk to him, but he's not, she ends up getting mad at it because it doesn't act exactly, she got it because she wanted him to act exactly like her husband, but he was there to please her, so he wasn't exactly like her husband. So, you know, that computer part of things will change the way we do things.
I think the audiobooks, too, have had a big impact and will continue to expand also. I'd like to do an audiobook of mine. I haven't gotten around to doing it yet, but it's on the radar. I think that that's probably still very in its infancy, still has a long way to grow, the audiobooks.
Yeah, I think today's consumer likes audiobooks because they can listen to them in the car. They can do this. They're all very busy. You know, they don't have to sit down and think. But here again, that is reach change. And that's something we should be thinking about as individuals, that it changes the way our brain works. Are you going to be able to consume content when you're reading if you're only doing audiobooks? But I would like to do an audiobook too.
AI is so scary for me. I don't know. It's exciting, but it's also very scary. I think there's a certain, I think you can kind of tell like something's just not quite right. But I wonder if most consumers care. That's the scary part.
Well, and do you want a computer telling you what information you should have and what information you shouldn't have? How does it decide which one it's going to give you?
Yeah, it's scary. Yeah. So I guess coming back a little bit to the writing portion, you know, with outlining, drafting, editing, should someone have their manuscript edited? And if so, by what type of editor before submitting it to a publisher.
Do you have any thoughts, Bob? I got two kinds, but I'll let you go first.
Yeah, it should definitely be edited. Maybe even have various people look at it and maybe edit it. You want the main thing when you're looking for it in editing is to keep your own voice, though, in the manuscript. You don't want the editor to edit it so much that your own voice is not discernible. That's pretty much it. Editing changes with the times too. You know, like I think it was Fitzgerald or one of these guys had a sentence that was like over 600 words long, just one sentence in one of his books. And then you have other sentences that are only one word. So, and everything in between. So editing is not one size fits all, you know. It's like anything else. Get an editor that you're comfortable with, but I would definitely get one.
And then there's two kinds of editing. There's content editing, and then there's line editing. Content can be somebody that just is willing to read through it and tell you if there's some inconsistencies or something's just not relatable in what you're writing. You know, maybe it's not, you know, exactly, you know, flowing or slow down here, speed up there. That's fine. You know, that's a content editor. And that's usually you can do that with like a beta reader or somebody that's just, you know, that's willing to read and give feedback. And then you go back and fix that. That could be a friend. That could be someone that just reads a lot in your genre. And then the line editing part of it to make sure that you want a professional book. There is no such thing as a perfect document. That's why there's different editions. So if you have a professional writer, editor, read through it and say, oh, you used the wrong ensure, or you know, whatever, you know, that you didn't pick up. It doesn't mean you didn't know it. It means that when you were sitting there typing and you were in your creative space, you know, you didn't take the time to differentiate the word choice or the, you know, the grammar or periods missing and you thought it was there or that you put double spaces between each sentence, whatever it might be, and that's not considered professional. So yes, definitely editors.
For both of you, was there ever a time when you felt like giving up and there's something that happened and you were just out of your limit? Tell me about that time and what made you continue. What was it that made you push through those self-doubts or whatever issue you were facing?
After a while, you definitely you have to dig deep into really wanting to get your work out there because there's times when you don't even want to look at it anymore. You've read through it so many times that, you know, let somebody else carry the ball here. But, you know, you step back from it for a while. That's why you shouldn't rush it out there. If you rush it out there, then, you know, you might regret it later. If you take your time with it and let it go for a while, then come back to it. It's fresher. You might even have some new ideas, too. So it helps to step back and take it slowly.
And for me, I wrote mine and it sat for a while because life hit. And finally, my sister said, "What is stopping you?" You know, when you go to conferences, they say some of the best novels are in people's closets, never been published.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Well, I've got this, and I've got this, and I've got this, and I've got this," you know. And so she's like, "No, that's not why it's not getting published." Mm. And I was like, "Well, what? Why then? If you're so smart, you know, you tell me." What's really going on here? And she said, "You're afraid to be vulnerable."
Huh.
And I'm like, "I'm not afraid to be vulnerable. I'm vulnerable every day. I live in this world." And she's like, "No, if you put it out there, that means you have to hear what other people say." And I was like, "Okay, well, you may not have exactly the vulnerability that you have in your, but I can see your point. I started looking for publishers, you know, like the next day. The vulnerability was taking the time for me and doing it. I was putting everybody else first and my goals and dreams second, you know? And so, yes, you do. You stop, or when you've had a bad sales week, or you get a big zero, you know, on a week of sales or whatever it might be, you're like, I'm going to push this book out the window. I wish I was on a skyscraper. But then you realize that, wait a minute, it's bigger than that. You've done the hardest part of the work. You've realized your dream, which was you got published. You did what most, I mean, and there's not a time that you're out there as an author that someone says, oh, I've been wanting to write a book, or do you have any tips on, there's a lot of people out there that have that desire, but they just haven't taken the steps to do it. So once you've actually done it, then it becomes kind of an addiction. It's like a love-hate thing.
Yeah, it's a bad thing. You want more of your stuff out there for sure.
Yeah.
On those bad sales weeks, I'm sure everyone experiences them, a bad week or a bad stretch of time. What are some ways to kickstart and to get a book that's been published for a little while, to get it, kind of get it in more people's hands, or to kind of get more attention to it? What are some methods that both of you have tried to kind of jumpstart?
First, you have to review what you did differently. You know, like for me, I'm getting a lot of my sales right now off of the Amazon and Barnes & Noble websites versus in the bookstores, even though I have them in the bookstores. And that is a new thing for probably in the last 2 or 3 months. And that was, I started running some of the Amazon sales. You know, they have ads that they can do where they can feature it. And I started spending more time with my profile. I looked at it and it looked like a resume. It didn't look like a book. You know, I had everything in the kitchen sink listed in it. And I had to say, okay, let's change this. But then I realized, okay, that was something I could do differently. I started looking at, so reflect on what you're doing and then change it some. So maybe you've burnt out one of your areas, because then you can turn around and say, okay, have I used Goodreads yet? Have I, you know, kind of bouncing from different methods of doing things is important. So
my fallback position is to give Rhonda a call and say, hey, Rhonda, how about some sales?
So you have to put some thinking caps on and start thinking about stuff, yeah. You know, and you know, hey, what about this person's website, or what about this person? And then you, because sometimes you've just gotten, you need to refresh. You have to refresh.
Yeah.
You have to think of a new way of doing it. You know, who have you, you know, what podcast have you talked to today? What, you know, what bookstores have you talked to? Like, I make a lot of excuses for why I haven't called more bookstores. I have a spreadsheet. It's beautiful. It's got, you know, 100 different Barnes and Nobles, you know, emails. Why haven't I done my newsletter? This, you know, there's different ways of reaching your audience. And you sometimes, the ones that are effective take the most thought, and you steer your time away from it. So you have to be willing to keep on, and you have to be willing to hit that no. You know, and you know that somebody's going to say no. And sometimes emotionally, you're just not ready for it.
It's tough. Yeah. are newsletters effective? Because I know it sounds like a lot of time goes into them. Are they an effective strategy?
I would say in staying in contact with the people. So like at every book signing, I have a notebook, and I tell them if they want to be part of my newsletter, and if they want to get updates when my next book's coming out, you know, to give me their email. And then I use a product called MailChimp, which means I only have to do it once, and I put them all in there. And anytime, you know, so I'm able to pull all my emails together. And I just do it quarterly. I'm not one that can do it every month or every week or whatever, but I'll send something out on updates, you know, whether it be the podcasts I've been in on or the, you know, book, the new book signings I'm going to have. I do them to keep in contact with the people that have showed me support and let them know what's going on with me.
Yeah, I've been doing them once every couple of weeks or when something, you know, unexpected happens. I've been doing them individually, though. I need to use MailChimp or one of those. It takes a lot of time the way I do it. I send them individual, like personalized emails.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would take a long time. Yeah. Long time. Yeah.
Well, sometimes I group them together, but it's still, you know, it takes a while.
Yeah, and a program like MailChimp or something like that, it looks like it's an individual, like an personal one, everybody at once. You say, I want it to be sent on this time.
Hmm. Yeah, it can be time intensive, I guess, in the beginning when you set it all up, and then it kind of it isn't as bad, it sounds like.
Right. Then you could just write an article or whatever, the update or an email or, you know, letter, and then you can send it all out.
Yeah, that's getting back to that social media thing from before. That's a good thing to do, is write a blog once in a while that has nothing to do with your book, but maybe related to your book. Like the other day, I wrote a little piece about an angler fish. Did you see that one, Rhonda?
Yeah.
Yeah. An angler fish. I put it out there, and it's not really about my book, but it's kind of along the same subject. And, you know, I keep people interested doing things like that.
Yeah, fun updates for sure. Both of you had mentioned about, you want to mix it up a little bit, not be so much promotion 100% of the time. You want to seem like a human being. So that helps out.
Because while you're in this process, part of it is engaging with the audience, and so that they understand you and your mindset when you're writing. So, you know, whether it be how you picked, you know, like in my case, I have different sites. All of my sites and Crossroads, it are real places in Indianapolis. So if they ever want to go, and they've had a little history. So like the lawyer, Dave, when he's walking around the circle to go back to work, after a scenario, he remembers his grandfather talking about, you know, the statue and the way, you know, what it was for and what it meant. And so then if someone comes and visits Indianapolis, they're like, oh, that's, this, you know, the they have something to think about. So.
And for both of you, are either of you concerned about becoming stagnant or about writing in different genres to keep things fresh or to employ different techniques to kind of expand your repertoire? Or is it something that you try to focus on the genre that you're writing in now?
To improve, I want to do different things, but I want to keep the reader knowing that it's a work that I did, like in this baseball and poem thing that I have with football. I like the wordplay, and I want the reader to be able to identify, oh yeah, I know him. That's what I'm looking for.
And I like the escape of fiction, but I want to do the self-help part of it. So for each book, like for Crossroads, it has the life balance workbook that someone could go and get. And then for Chosen, since it's about a young woman that because of her upbringing and the way that she thinks, she's easily victimized. That's why the name's Chosen, because I want then a workbook where we can teach each other how to be more aware of why things happen to us. So, you know, for instance, you know, a young woman may be taught at a young age, don't keep eye contact or do this. But those are things that, you know, a predator would look for. You know, don't scream, don't be loud, don't be, you know, all these things that we might do. So I will have a workbook that also that can help them, you know, you teach yourself and others how not to, to be, you know, prey.
It's very good advice, very good things to learn for sure for all walks of life, to be aware of your surroundings and what's around. For both of you mentioned research and researching topics for whatever it is you're writing. What are some of the most interesting things you've discovered by accident or on purpose during that research for your books?
Well, I discovered two really actually three. Should I tell them all, or should I let the reader?
As many as you want. We don't spoil anything.
But. All right. Well, the Mediterranean Sea is really long. It's bigger than the Gulf of Mexico by like 3 to 1, I think. And but that wasn't the interesting thing. The interesting thing is, though, in that long vastness of ocean, that's from, I think, from Europe all the way to Africa, I believe. It, there's only one way in and out of there, and it's only 9 miles wide. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that. And the Mediterranean, I don't know about anymore, but it used to be great for tuna fishing. But tunas, they go in huge schools, you know? And I'm thinking, if this, it's only 9 miles, all the commercial boats would have to do is just wait there for them, you know? And, yeah, that blew me away. One thing that I really found interesting was the Sea of Galilee in Israel is actually fresh water. It's a freshwater lake. I didn't know that. I thought it was part of the Mediterranean Sea, but it's not. It's landlocked. It's below sea level. And that's where Jesus calmed the seas, was in the Sea of Galilee. And it's freshwater lake. I never knew that. I learned that when I was writing the book, among other things. But those are two to wet the people's whistles.
And for me, boy, mine's so much different.
Yeah.
So mine's suspense, crossroads suspense, remember? So I one of the things that I did in research is I rode with the police.
That's really cool, yeah.
And I learned how they navigate the whole scene and how it's so much different than how we work in our own worlds, because they can't do anything to help them help each other through those processes, because there's certain procedures they have to get to. So it's almost like a sporting event. You have to stay in your position. You have to do what you're, but meanwhile, the only thing that they can do is provide, even if it's a female officer, they have to provide kind of that masculine energy to get through whatever the trauma or drama that they're going through. The other thing that I learned, I wasn't sure how people, when they're under that kind of stress, actually like report what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I listened to 911 calls. There's an app where you can listen to them and you can hear them, you know, the stress in their voice and the timing, and to write that. And of course, I didn't make it easy for myself, because the person calling in the crime was a young boy with a stutter. So that, you know, but I realized the stretching of that voice was real important in making it believable. So mine's quite different.
Yeah.
Ron, earlier you talked about how you develop your characters, and also Bob, this is for you too, but how do you both develop characters, or what are some techniques that you use to build your characters, to get them ready for action?
I try to just get their personality, you know, bring out their personality, things they might say or the way they might react to certain situations. And I just try to bring that out to you know, to the word on the paper.
And for me, I use, because of my research background, I use a medical model. So when you go into a doctor's office, they have what's called a soap note. And the soap note is, okay, what's your chief complaint? Okay, I have a sore throat. And then they go through every one of your body parts and they say, what's happening here? What's happening there? You know, and then, and, you know, no, I don't have a stomach ache with it. You know, and they go through every part and they document what you say. And then, so that's the person's view of themselves. And they also know then the family, you know, history of, you know, medical history and emotional history and psychological history. So they write all that. And down, and then they write what they see. There is no sore throat. It's in the chest, you know, just, you know, and they're dressed inappropriately for the weather. They have a flat affect emotion. They have emphysema. They have a history of hypochondriac or whatever it might be. You know, their parents died of at an early age. So they're needy, whatever it might be. And then, when I get into a scene, I know how they're going to react then. They have emphysema, they're going to cough. You know, they have anxiety, they're going to have chest pain, whatever it might be. And then we end up, you know, then I end up, if I get writer's block, I just have to go back to my characters. I can go back and say, well, how would they act in this situation? They have anxiety or they have, you know, they're depressed or, you know, what are they going to say by what, but why, by what they have? And I use the DSM-5 mental health guidance book to give me a little checklist then of what they're going to have for each one of those illnesses or experiences.
Wow. That's detailed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really go deep, dive deep into the psyche of characters.
Right.
Wow. Do you have a big wall with strings and pictures and everything to keep it all straight?
I have a storyboard that I create, but I pretty much, you know, put it binder. And then if I get stuck, I go shopping. I mean, and I can go on Amazon, pick out an outfit. I can pick out the house that they're going to be in, you know. Oh, I like this house. Okay, so now the house has pillars and the has three bedrooms or whatever it might be, and then go from there.
Yes. For both of you, do you ever absorb stories from other types of storytelling, whether it be movies or even music or other genre, other types of entertainment for inspiration?
Oh yeah. Always learn from other authors. And it's continual too. The learning never stops. Find out what techniques they used and how you can make some of those techniques your own. You know, I'm not saying to copy exactly what they do, but learn why a work is good and try to apply that in your own work for sure.
Yeah. And you can learn, and it can put you in the mood for what you're writing, you know, so whether it be music or whether it be reading someone else's work or, you know, let's say you are stuck on something and you like, you know, how do an officer, you know, do this? Or how does an author do a transition from this kind of topic to this topic? Go look at books then, you know. How many pages is the average page for a, you know, a suspense novel versus a a self-help book? You know, you learn what other authors have done so that you don't want to duplicate, but you want to make sure that you're getting all the elements of your genre.
Well, the time has flown by. So I looked at the time, but I do have a couple of fun questions for you left. Not to keep you so soon, but I try to ask everybody these questions because I think they're fun. But for both of you, do you have any favorite family recipes?
I come from a Latin background, and you know, arroz con pollo y platanitos, and and you know, that kind of thing. The plantains, the especially the ripe ones, I like. The tostones are the more crispy ones. They're good too, but I like the ripe ones just a bit better. And Latin, the beans, you know, for the exact recipes, I don't know, but I know I can eat them.
So now, are you a cook? Do you cook anything, or are you just on the other end of it, like me, because I can't cook anything?
I enjoy cooking my own fish when I've caught fish. I really enjoy cooking my own catch. Other than that, I don't really take that much pleasure in cooking because I it's just time consuming for me. You know, I'd rather just be sending out some of those emails we talked about.
For me, I love cooking. And I come from, if you wanted to know anything about my family, they've probably been here since dirt. I would never have thought that, but there, it's home cooking kind of things, noodles and chicken. And, but one of my favorite, other than the chicken and noodles, you know, and dumplings made from scratch, one of my favorite things are Buckeyes. My grandmother used to make the, I wish I could make her pies, but I've not mastered it like she did, but she owned a cafeteria and she comes from Quakers, so everything's, you know, made from scratch. And Buckeyes are basically like a peanut butter dipped in chocolate. But you make your own peanut butter filling, and then you dip it, and then you put it in the refrigerator and eat it. So you have your own, instead of Reese's cup, you have your own.
Oh, wow. Can't go wrong with peanut butter and chocolate. Yeah. Another question is, what was your first job and what did you learn from that experience that's stayed with you through your life?
I don't exactly remember my first job. I know I remember one I had in my teens when we used to do insulation for home when I lived up north. I just remember, you know, you get up early and you work late, you know, that work ethic that that comes from, you know, that my dad and his dad had, you know, in Cuba, the people worked hard, really hard, and it just got transferred to me, and I've always been that way.
Kind of similar, but a little bit different for me. My father owned his own business, and he started it in a barn. It was a steel mill. It's now a mid-sized steel manufacturing plant in the Indiana area that does auto parts and for some of the big auto, you know, Firestone, General Motors, etc. But he started it in a barn, so our whole family worked from like age five on. If you were old enough to count two, then you were sitting, putting these little plastic feet in a bag, and while you were watching TV and putting it in there. And then as you got older, you could work on the paint line. And if anybody that's done manufacturing, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. You sit there with a spray gun, and you're next to an oven, and you're spraying the metal as it goes in or out, depending on which finish you're doing. And then as you got a little older, you started doing bending steel with, you know, running around these little pipes that, you know, to bend it, because he was the number one manufacturer also for aquarium stands.
Oh, cool.
For the longest time. So they did the steel aquarium stands with the little circular, you know, insets on the side to hold the shelving together. That was the first job. So we were a family that worked. But then when I went to go on my own, I was like, I'm out of the manufacturing. And I worked at like a Payless and an Arby's, and the typical teenage jobs.
I can see where the entrepreneurial spirit came from, but definitely with that childhood. Yeah. That to keep, you know, to kind of to thrive and to foster or something like that. That
My father used to always say, "You have to work to eat," and then he would say, "If it's meant to be, it's up to you." And so everybody out there that wants to write and follow any of their dreams, if it's meant to be, it's up to you to do it. Nobody else can do it for you.
Well said. Yeah, well said for sure. So the last question I have for both of you, something I like to ask everyone that just so I can, you know, kind of get feedback. But if the roles were reversed, if you were in my position, was there a question that you would have asked that I did not ask?
Of us or of you?
Of you, if you were in my position.
What would you have asked? So when can we go fishing?
I'm down that way for sure. I hope to go to ICFA, the conference next March, I think. So maybe we can figure something out.
In Florida? You want to be in Florida, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what part of Florida?
I think it's on the west side. I forget exactly where it was. Yeah. I'll look. I think it's, or I don't know. I'll have to find out, but yeah, I think it's in Florida somewhere. I don't know
where. Email me. Let me know where it is. I'm down in Naples right now. But yeah, email me.
Cool.
I think I would ask, what's your inspiration?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. What would be your inspiration?
For me, it's to prove that I can do it. You know, it's an internal thing. I have muses at different times, like, you know, to do different parts of the work. It might be music. It might be, you know, nature. It could be any of those things. But the inspiration is wanting to accomplish it and to the best of my ability. Nice.
It's sometimes the internal kind of, just to prove that you can do it is one of the strongest drivers of to get to accomplish something.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thanks to both of you. I really appreciate it. The time just flew by.
It did. Yeah. Thank you, Steve. Yeah. It was fun. And maybe we can do it again with our next books.
Yeah, for sure. And welcome back anytime. And in the meantime, if someone's wanted to connect with either of you, where's the best place to find both of you?
Well, I'll go first. My website, flickerinthewater.com. There's lots of videos there. There's things about the oceans people will find interesting. And my book is good for all ages. You know, kids from like 8 years old, I think, all the way up to adult can really enjoy it.
And for me, I tried to make it easy. It's RhondaParkerTaylor.com for the website, all of my social media, unless it's something like X is what? Rhonda PTI or whatever they do. But if you type in Rhonda Parker Taylor, you'll still get me.
Nice. Well, thanks again to both of you. Really, it was just a pleasure. But hope to do it again soon.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, Annette. Hope everyone has a fantastic weekend.